Good morning. Today is Thursday, August 11th, 2005. We're here at Freiburg New Church Assembly for the first lecture of the day. This is the first week. The theme is Families in the Bible, and I've selected the family of Moses. Because Moses and his work is such a huge subject, we're certainly not going to be able to in any way cover the whole story, but I wanted to focus on Moses as a family man, because from the Ten Commandments movie, we often see and we often remember vividly the exploits while he is with Aaron confronting Pharaoh and leading the people out of Egypt. So our theme provides a focus that we'll be looking at the fact that Moses was a person who came into the world in the usual way. He had a father and a mother, and in this case he had also a stepmother, so to speak, Pharaoh's daughter, his brother Aaron, and sometimes we don't remember the sister's name. Women don't get that big of a laudit in the Bible always. Miriam, his wife Zipporah, and his sons Gershom and Eliezer, and his father-in-law Jethro. So I'm going to have as an introductory remark some overview about Moses, followed by a few family situations. And we'll remember and keep in mind that the holiness of the Bible as the Word of God lies at being written in what Swedenborg calls the divine style. In other words, it's a story about what happened back in Bible times, but written in such a way that through these big images we can imagine things that take place in our lives. So one of the things that we'll be looking at is what does Pharaoh represent within ourselves as well as the king of Egypt, and what does Moses represent within ourselves and Aaron and so on. The setting of the story of Moses begins at the end of Genesis after Israel's son Joseph, having long since been sold in by his brothers to people in Midian and then become a slave in Egypt, eventually rises to prominence as Pharaoh's second in command. As the Pharaoh said, "You'll be second to me only as to the throne." And a great famine befalls not only the land of Canaan, but eventually the whole area. But there is grain in Egypt, and the children of Israel hear about it and travel to purchase grain, and there's the poignant stories of the reunion of Joseph and his brothers. Famine continues, and when the money fails, everyone in Egypt willingly negotiates with Joseph to become servants of Pharaoh in exchange for food in order to survive. Shortly after Jacob's death, Joseph reassures his brothers, saying, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And then Joseph dies, and in the opening verses of Exodus, his brothers, Joseph's brothers, also die, and those of that generation. Meanwhile, the Israelites multiply in number, and the Egyptians, just as many people in countries today, fear these immigrants that had come into their land, that they might become more and mightier and get a majority and perhaps elect the Congress and their own leader, and actually that they would become more and mightier, and then they might side with enemies and leave. So first, slave masters severely oppress them, and yet the more they are oppressed, the more they multiply and spread. Finally, the king announces to the, well, not finally, the penultimate, the king announces to the Hebrew midwives to kill the boys and let the girls live. But they disobey, and Pharaoh gives the same orders to his own people concerning the Hebrew children. And it was into this setting then that Moses was born. And what this means, or what we take as we read Swedenborg's writings on it, and actually Canaan is not just a Swedenborgian symbol, but just about everybody takes Canaan to be the symbol for heaven and heavenly living, storied in song and literature. Egypt represents our external physical natural states and our mind, our interests, our involvement in natural science, learning, knowledge, gaining a profession, working in the world, all our worldly interests and pleasures. Now, there's a key difference. In Egypt, while Joseph is still alive, and after Joseph dies, when the natural states represented by the involvement in the world by Egypt, when Joseph is alive and these natural involvements serve our spiritual growth, that's all right, that's one that's spendable. I know that's up here. So when Joseph is alive, it represents our spiritual acknowledgement that there is a God. And then our involvement in the world serves our self, and we are a whole self. But when Joseph dies, or when our acknowledgement that there is a God and there's a heavenly life and there are things we should be doing to prepare ourselves for heavenly living, when that aspect dies, then this physical world can destroy ourselves, and the children of Israel become enslaved, the Egyptians become the masters, and the children are destroyed. And this is represented by Israel taking up residence in Egypt. It seems they forgot that their land of promise was the land of Canaan. And Moses has to be told the name of God. All these things are forgotten when they've taken up residence down in the land of Goshen, or the best of the land, actually, of Egypt. But when Joseph is alive, then the children of Israel are finding that the development of their spiritual life is furthered by their work in the world, and Joseph is ruler in Egypt, and it's a happy home for Israel. So that the difference after Joseph dies. When the children of Israel are enslaved in Egypt represents a crisis in spiritual life that calls for a new leader, and that's really how the role of the Ten Commandments, we often learn them as children, and we become involved in Egypt and may forget about things. But then when we have a crisis, then we need to realize there are these commandments and the law of God. Now, this is where I thought I would interject the missing paper. Reverend McCurdy had this here. He didn't have the little rays, but this is like all the rays. This is life. And it's divine love and divine wisdom. And it goes into our understanding and into our will, our volition.
The Lord is pictured as
now,
a circle.
What we're going to find out is that there's
influx flowing.
Well,
down.
All diagrams are wrong, right? But this is going to be as best I can do. I'm just going to draw this little thing there, and I'm going to call this human work. And this is God's work over here.
The human mind divided in half, God's work on the upper left.
And Swedenborg right. talks about how the Lord actually infuses, he calls it, influx, but the Lord hidden to us, can't remember the word, it'll come to me eventually. But the Lord instills this, and without our doing it, He puts in good into our love, and it is that inspires us to seek the wisdom. And our part is to learn truths from the Word. Swedenborg many times says, "It is not a violation of our freedom for us to learn truths from the Word and seek to follow them." That's our part. There's God's influx comes in two ways, and one is mediated, and one is immediate. God comes right into our life in our inmost being, and that's why we're alive. And there's nobody in between. But through the Bible, then as we read the Bible, the angels are with us. The Lord is seeking to stir up our affections for what is good and what is true. And then truth comes in an immediate way. But our role, then this is Moses then over here. This was what Moses' work was to bring the divine truth down to human level and to be God's agent that way. And we'll look at a couple family situations to see how that works. Is it Harry Chapin that says he came into the world in the usual way? A man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. And so these were from the holy tribes. The Levites eventually, as one of the tribes, were given, through the commandments of Moses, they were given the holy work to do, to manage the ark and all of the religious paraphernalia. But the Levites were the ones that were representing God's love. And so they have a son, that's God's truth. And in the highest sense, the way in which humans become knowledgeable is through the law of God, the word, and in its relative sense, Moses represents God's truth with each individual member of the church. So Moses is within us as that aspect that listens to God and understands and takes it. Now, I can't go into all the details of it, but Moses grows up in Pharaoh's house. And when it's what that represents is Moses at the palace. Moses is treated kindly by the Egyptians. The Pharaoh's daughter takes him as a son. He learns everything there is within the culture, and he really is seen as quite prominent until he sees a Hebrew being beaten and kills an Egyptian and looks around and covers him up in the sand. And then he tries to settle an argument, and his own people recognize, are you going to kill us like the Egyptian? And so he realizes he's got to take it on the lamb. So he goes to Midian. And that's where he gets his wife. So if we look at Moses' life, it divides into three periods of 40 years. The first 40 years, he's born, he grows up in the palace, he learns all the aspects of knowledge that the Egyptians knew. He kills an Egyptian, he escapes to Midian. He rescues Jethro's shepherdess daughters. What he does is, as soon as he gets out of Egypt into the country to the side, Midian, he comes to a well, and there are these shepherdesses, and there are these other shepherds that are driving him away from the water. You know, like, we're going to take first, and then you wait. And so he must have been quite an imposing fellow. He didn't mind killing this Egyptian, right? And he had all this knowledge, and he was quite a powerful person. And so he chases these people off, and then the daughters go home, and it's a surprise to Jethro, because he says, how come you're home so early? You know, he's used to them having to wait their turn and so forth. He says, well, there's this Egyptian drove off the people that were there, and he even fed our, watered our flock. And so Jethro says, well, you know, this is a violation of hospitality. He says, why didn't you invite him home? You know, he did a good deed. And so they go back and they find Moses, and they bring him home. And then Jethro, well, that's the cultural way of those days. He gives one of these daughters to his newly adopted, soon-to-be son-in-law, Zipporah, and children are born there. And then there's a second, so that's the first 40 years, and then there's a second 40 years where he grows up there. And life begins at 80. He's 80, and we find out in the seventh chapter that Aaron is his older brother. He was 3 years older. He was 83, and Moses was 80. Evidently, Aaron didn't have to go through all this business of hiding from the Egyptians, because he was born before the edict to kill all the male sons. And Miriam must have been old enough at least to watch what was happening, and you know, to go find the Moses' actual mother, birth mother, to bring to the Pharaoh's daughter when she says, shall I go get the mother? Or shall I go get someone to nurse the child? And so she brings the mother there. So in the third 40 years is what we think of as the law giving. Begins with the burning bush incident. And then that's the setup for the this first family situation that I want to go into, which is the fact of the excuses. That's part of my favorite ones. You know, it's the idea of belling the cat. All the mice thought it would be good, you know, if the cat had a bell on its neck, then it'd be pretty good for them because they'd always hear the cat coming. But then they'd find out, well, which of the mice is going to put, you know, actually going to put this bell on the cat? And so it's like God's looking around for someone to lead the people of Israel out. I mean, this is told from a human perspective. I find the humor in it, and I think it is because it also has to do with myself. You know, I get myself into these situations. It would be a lot easier not to give the lecture today, for example. But once you do it, you have to go ahead and go through with it. So anyway, they're the excuses. You know, I've never been eloquent. Ambiguous idea because, I mean, he seems to make himself heard here and there, but it must be that I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what his speech problem was, but it turned out that evidently he was slow of speech, and it becomes a good symbolism, actually, as we look at Swedenborg's ideas on it. And God gives him the ideas, you know, I'll go with you. Well, first is, you know, I don't know your name. What am I going to say when I get there? If they ask you, you know, the God of your fathers has come to your room. What's his name? So he says, well, this is my name, and goes through. And then he says, well, you'll have this magic walking stick that you know you can really use and show power. And I'll do the power, but you'll be there to carry the stick to where the stick needs to go. And finally, Moses running out of excuses. He's really scratching. He says, well. Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither now nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. So the Lord said, who made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say. But he said, I mean, that wipes out his last excuse. So he says, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. In other words, oh, please send someone else. I mean, Pharaoh, you know. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And they always talk about God having anger, but, you know, he really doesn't. But it's good for the... So he says, well, isn't Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And look, he's coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he'll be glad of heart. And you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. I'll be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. And you'll take this rod in your hand in which you'll do all these signs. So finally it gets down to we have to do what we have to do to get what we have to get done. And so Moses has to go. But I like the representation here. The truth that Moses here represents is that which cannot be heard or perceived. But the truth that Aaron represents is that which can be heard and perceived. And as we go through life, we find more and more there's this inarticulate a part of ourselves that we know something, but we don't know how we know it, and we don't know exactly how to explain it to someone else. If you haven't had that experience right yet, it's following your hunch, and it can get you into trouble, but perhaps 83% of the time it'll be good. But Moses represents God trying to get a message through to us, and as I mention to my wife every now and then, you know, the trouble is the angels don't speak all that loud. Sometimes you have to figure things out and act as if you know what they are. And then I like the aspect of Jethro's delegation. There was a spot that I had the fathers-in-laws. There's a rather extended family situation, and it's one of those ones that there's a lot in it to try to unpack. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moses and Israel, his people. He had taken Zipporah and his two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, and they had gone toward Egypt. And there was a period of time where he sent the family back. I guess he knew it was going to get rough, so he sent the family back away from the front where all the action was going to be. And then here Jethro's bringing the family back again. And so, you know, just with our theme for the week, the importance of family, I really think that for Moses, to have been Moses, he really needed that family. And the fact that he had children, and, you know, it really counted what was going to happen. But Jethro heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he said, I've been a stranger in a foreign land. They always named their children. It's sort of like people like to pick particular dates so that they can remember them. Well, what they did was they named their children so they could kind of remember when this child was born. Well, this child was born when he was a stranger in the land of Midian. And he sent a message, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and two sons with her. And Swedenborg talks pretty clear about the relationships between father-in-law and mother-in-law and son-in-law, husband and wife. Here we are. And Jethro, the father-in-law, took Zipporah, the wife of Moses, means the good from God that had been joined to God's truth is coming to him. And this is the representation of Jethro as divine good, the source of all the good to which the truth was joined. In other words, Moses needed this aspect of good that he inherited, tendencies toward good, that would then enable him to receive the truth from God. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and that means the truth and the good are coming together. And then there is the whole aspect of the good things that in-laws can do. So Moses goes out the next day to do what he usually does, and what he does is he set up a chair, and everybody'd come to him all day long, you know, from the beginning of the morning till the, you know, till after sunset. And you remember this story probably. And he would see, Moses was the mouthpiece of God. Don't ask me how he was able to talk there. I don't know whether Aaron was with him or not, but anyway, he had a way of making himself known. People would come with their problems, and he would solve them. Or he'd tell them what God's truth was that was relative to that. And his father-in-law said, really what you need to do is to develop an organization here, and you need to work as the CEO, and you need people that have some abilities to line people up and deal with the smaller problems, and they'll take care of the smaller problems, and then the ones that they can't take care of, you take care of. And later, this was ritualized in what was called a tent of meeting. Outside, there'd be all the children of Israel in the campground, and he'd set up this tent of meeting out there, and there was the pillar of cloud that would kind of be over it. And people could go and find out what God had to do. So Moses, if we can catch that imagery without getting lost in the details, it's a beautiful story about how Moses represents that aspect that helps us in the same way as it helped the children of Israel. That there's this tent of meeting, and that there was the sense that the people didn't know what to do, but Moses would not know what to do, but he would go to the tent of meeting, and God would give him the answer. And it sort of represents in our spiritual growth in life that of ourselves, we really are not going to be able to know the answers to many things. As far as the natural world is concerned, and you know what our vocation and job is supposed to be, we're supposed to know that, and we eventually learn those things. But as to the big things in life, the decisions we're going to make, we really do well to turn them over to God in the same way as the children of Israel turned over the decision-making to Moses, to say, Moses, you go to God for us. And then Moses would come back and tell them. And that's really an aspect of our prayer and meditation life. I'm going to leave a lot of time here because there are so many aspects of Moses' life. I'm not going to have the answer to all of them, but I just like people to, aspects of his life that I didn't mention here that mean something to you if you remember things about Moses or have questions about what was going on. But Moses represents the divine truth coming down into our understanding and our learning the truths, the commandments. Oh, I wanted to emphasize one more thing about the commandments. One more thing. The idea of the Ten Commandments is not really news to anybody. It really wasn't. I mean, not to murder, not to covet, all these things. But the whole idea of them being given by Moses is to represent something really important. They don't just deal with legal criminal behavior, whether we can, as the criminal element will say, whether they can beat the rap, whether they'll be legally charged with something, or whether it's moral. But actually, the idea of the Ten Commandments being given from Mount Sinai is to represent that they're sinful. And sin is simply separation. And so it is that when Moses, going back to Moses killing this Egyptian, when he looked around and didn't see anybody, and then he hit him in the sand, we can just say, well, that was a falsity represented by the Egyptian, attacking a spiritual aspect represented by the Hebrew. And so there's all this warfare, and it all represents that stuff. But as we delve deeply into it, we can't go by a week without hearing somebody's been found out because they killed someone and put them in a shallow grave or whatnot. The thought that external behavior doesn't matter, it does matter because it is a separation. It separates us from, if we were to become involved in evil, it would separate us from our families and from our loved ones and essentially from God, because nothing can be hidden from God. So the whole idea of whether it's moral or criminal, or whether there's enough evidence to convict, really doesn't matter from the standpoint that there's a separation that happens with our evils. And Swedenborg says that, or helps us to understand that, really the angels will look at our motives. I mean, we can't help but say something or do something that seems right to us that somehow will offend someone else, or someone else will take an offense. We can't really figure it all out, because someone may take an offense at something we do that we didn't really intend it, and we don't know why it would happen. So we will all have certain aspects of involvement in things that are unwittingly hurtful or whatever, and we have to find a way to have reconciliation and ask for forgiveness and all that, and the angels. And what our theology says is that these evils aren't really ever washed off of us or surgically removed in some way, but they're pushed out to our periphery as things that really aren't part of our core self. So the whole process of discovery of our core self is part of what is involved with the idea of divine truth coming into our lives and our meditating on it. As promised, I'm going to now turn the floor to the people.
When you were talking about Moses saying, not being able to speak, it never really struck me that, you know, when he saw that each time he didn't speak, he just acted. When he saw the Egyptian beating the Hebrew, you know, I mean, you think of him, you know, what's the kid's movie, Moses, Prince of Egypt? He didn't try to use his power to get this man thrown in prison. He just killed him. He didn't kind of go through the channels. And also then when he was accused by his own people, he there again didn't use any words or anything to, I mean, he did it in their behalf in a sense, but he didn't try to use words to talk his way out of it and get them on his side. He just ran away. So I thought that was interesting to kind of think of it in that way.
Just one little thing first. I'm sure being a prince of Egypt, he was well trained in the martial arts of the time. So he was. That's probably why he was easily vanquished these shepherds out in the middle of nowhere. But one thing you said, we could bring up something you didn't mention. One of the hardest things to swaddle literally is when Moses is traveling back to Egypt with his family, and the Bible says the Lord was angered at him and wanted to kill him until he then circumcised his
Zipporah, son. Circumcised the child,
right,
and wipes it on his feet. That's a part that I actually had trouble with, and that's why I didn't mention it.
Oh, I would guess, you know, basically is that Moses and everything related to Moses had to be spiritually cleansed before he could do his work in Egypt. But that is an especially hard one literally, and
yes,
it's an interesting passage.
And it's further interesting when she takes the foreskin from the circumcision of the son and wipes it on his feet, and he says, you will surely be a bridegroom of blood to me. And the blood, and there's a whole thing in Leviticus and other places about the sanctity of blood. And I mean, you know, this was back pre-medical. Well, there was some medical stuff. But, I mean, you know, blood just represents so much about life. But, yeah, I didn't get, it's hard to think that the Lord was going to kill Moses. I mean, here Moses is ready to do and be and the Lord stands in his way and is going to kill him with us. So I was a bit perplexed by that, even when looking through the Arcana Celestia and so forth. And perhaps I see George is raising his hand. Maybe George can help us here. We'll let George do it.
No, this is just one of my recurrent themes, and I'm going to keep saying say it until other people start saying it too, I think. I think the easiest way to come at it is to say the Bible records what people heard God say. They didn't necessarily hear him right. Our hearing is terrible. I do not believe that God told them to go in and slaughter the men, women, and children of Jericho. No, I think that's what they heard. And we have people today, we have Son of Sam saying, God told me to go kill these people. And right back to the story of the fall. Did God say, you will die if you eat this fruit? Well, if I take that spiritually, I think if you take the tree of knowledge of good and evil as an image of our sense of making our own decisions, you know, being our own person, that's something we need. But for heaven's sakes, don't swallow it whole. I think God is saying, don't swallow this whole. But the tree's got to be there. So again and again and again, we have trouble. Did God make this command? Look behind what people heard and say, what could have God have said that they would have heard in this fashion?
Yes, I still just don't know who this being was that was blocking the path, though, and that's something that people will ponder. Lee, when the microphone comes.
There also seems to be I think in both the Old Testament and the New, there's always a counterbalance to making heroes out of human characters in the Bible. And in Moses' case, there were the excuses, but there was also this little episode of God being ready to kill him. Well, if Moses was such a great guy, why, just looking at the literal story, why would God be ready to kill him? Well, an answer could be that Moses wasn't such a great guy, and it was really God who was the great guy. And therefore, there was a scene of demonstrating, in a sense, that Moses wasn't good, God was good. And I'm thinking also in the New Testament of the parable of the worthless stewards, or would be one way of putting it, that worthless servants, when we've done our job, that doesn't mean anything. We've just done what we're supposed to. So there's no particular virtue in our doing what God tells us to, not any virtue in us anyway. And God being ready to kill Moses says, you know, there's nothing great about Moses. He's just doing what he's supposed to.
Yes, and that was toward the start of the story, too, so that would have extra meaning there. Roy? Oh, well, okay.
An aspect then, of it that... was somebody else before me?
Well, either way.
His hand was up way back.
Oh.
I'm going to go a little further, being kind of a sketchy Swedenborgian. I didn't know that Moses represented God's truth. And then in some of the things that I learned, when he comes down, God makes a covenant with people in freedom. And what is that beautiful thing? I don't know. Leo, correct either my Hebrew or my biblical knowledge. I bore thee on eagle wings out of the land of Egypt that you could become my precious possession. So he offers this truth to people to accept. But knowing that the word precious possession is the word segula, and it means something within a culture of nomads where everything is owned in common, the tents, the rugs, the pots and pans, and a segula is something that's your own, your grandmother's ankle bracelet or something, you know, that's your own. So this also shows God's great love and closeness to us even before we have accepted the agreement to live according to the commandments.
I'm sorry, we'll get to you, Francesco.
Well, I like this story a lot. I find it very interesting because it seems to provide or at least it strikes me as providing a bit of a very social or familial aspect to its meaning. You pointed out the point that it's a crucial point that Moses had a family, and that was a very important thing. The fact that Aaron was with him by his side constantly, the fact that God worked directly through Moses, but he also worked through his brother, it really makes me think. I'm sure everyone in this room has been at some point in their lives where they feel very alone, where they're stuck asking, well, where are you at? What are you waiting for? I need you. And you feel kind of alone. And it brings the point that, especially in today's society, we're so stuck on wanting things immediately, and wanting things directly without waiting for them at all, that we do need to realize that God does work through us individually, and he is always there. But even though it may not seem like that all the time, all you have to really do is turn to your neighbor, turn to your family member. It shows how important our family is and our friends are, and it shows the importance of openness and commonality between us all, and it shows the importance of that, because God does work through us all. It's not a singular thing. It's on a whole level. It's through everyone that God works through us.
Thank you. I saw young men and then Lana once.
Yes, I heard the Lord give us in two way, where we receive a two way of a divine love and divine wisdom. And you said Moses represented divine truth. And actually, I always curious about the Moses and Aaron's, acting. And I think, a little clear because of you. And I point out when Moses had to escape from Egypt, because he had to kill one of the Egyptian. And then he met the shepherd's family, and and he had a family over there, and which means his divine truth had to meet divine loves. And but the way to the back to Egypt, one of they happened to be killed by God, but the circumstance of their family, their sons, and then he was relieved. He had saved, actually. And what you said is that you are the actually blood son. And that gives me an idea about the divine truth and with the divine love, and then go back to Egypt again. The Egypt is a represent of our the knowledge of natural knowledge of knowledge of science. So that gives me a more clear idea of what Moses and the God said is, Moses, you give the word to the Aaron. So Aaron say something, you know, what you said. And so divine truth has to be conjoined divine law. This is my thought.
It's a good thought. There was a part of Swedenborg that Jethro actually was priest of Midian, and I don't know exactly culturally what all that meant, but Swedenborg distills from it the idea that that he was he represented the truth that could be conjoined with those that are in simple good. So they were living a basically good life, and I mean a life that was good. And God has to start somewhere. He doesn't just bring the divine truth down into an empty vessel of Moses. He had to have the preparation and the good there, and then Zipporah being good from that truth.
I like the you know, the imagery of burying things in the sand, because what you're talking about, the divine truth, as you know, as the body as a receptacle, the things that we bury take up space, and it's that narrowness and limited of space and restrictions of the things that we bury in our life that maybe we're ashamed of, or the harms that we've caused people. We think they're buried, but they're not, and then they really limit the way that we can really handle and use God's truth. So
that helps amplify that, yes. Well, the station manager just gave me one of those signals, you know, close it up, move it on. So thank you for your kind attention.